nighttime when we went in there, so we wouldn't have seen that effect. And the other interesting thing is that it was completely decked up for the Scaresville. So I think this was just after Scaresville had taken place. And it was strewn with these enormous cobwebs. And we went in there because we'd heard from Philip that his daughter had gone in with some friends. And they'd had such a frightening experience that they ran out in the middle of the night and wandered around town and refused to come back until it was daylight. And they've never spoken about what it was that they experienced there.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Your Ghost Stories podcast. A few months back, I visited a place named Kentwell Hall in Suffolk, and whilst doing some research, I came across an interesting blog post from a writer named Sophia Adamovics. It was about how she had stayed the night in the haunted room in this huge manor house. Since then, we've spoken a little over email, and I thought it would be great to get Sophia on the show. So let's get on with it. Hey, Sophia, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me this evening. Please take us back to the start and tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, your background, and what keeps you busy today.
Thank you. So in this day and age, I'm a writer, live just outside Cambridge in a place called Newmarket. And I also tutor. So I tutor English and a bit of history. And also run writing workshops in East Anglia, so in Newmarket and Ely primarily. In terms of, you know, going right back to the start, I've always had this obsession with the supernatural and anything spooky. And I'd say there were sort of three big influences on me when I was a kid. So one was the National Trust ghost game. I don't know if you know it, but it's like a kind of card matching game. So you have the ghosts on some cards and then the National Trust properties on other cards, and you're supposed to, you know, it's like a memory game, be able to match them up without looking. And I got very interested in, you know, finding out which ghost haunts which property and then going to check out the different stately homes. So it was a great marketing tool by the National Trust. And then I was also, you know, really deeply interested in ghost films and, you know, supernatural horror. So I remember when I was about 4 years old, I was playing a board game with my dad one night, and the 1963 version of The Haunting came on TV. And, you know, the opening sequence is just so evocative. You know, it has Hill House silhouetted against a sky, and then the voiceover, like, an evil house, the kind that some people would call haunted. It's like an undiscovered country waiting to be explored. And I was totally entranced by this and just completely stopped what I was doing. And my parents had to record it, and I've just loved it ever since. And then I was also really into, you know, just looking at pictures of ghosts. So like in the National Trust game, but I also had this book called Ghosts, The Illustrated History by Peter Haining. And it was full of these amazing sort of spirit photographs. And sort of from there, I kind of adopted this persona of like a kind of ghost investigator, and I call myself Theodora after the character in The Haunting. And sort of wherever my parents took me, I would do like a little supernatural investigation. And I've got some notes in the front of it. So I stuck some Polaroid pictures of this house we stayed in called Southbome, which was near Horne Castle. And so my very dyslexic notes say, next to a graveyard and haunted, the feeling of something watching you and a dead rabbit in the garden was spooky. My grandma had the feeling of something in bed with her was scary. I fell down the stairs, shaken by the sight of an abnormal shadow. So that was me being convinced by that property. But then in the back, I have the Maynard Arms, and it says, it had a reputation of haunting, but I did not see or sense anything. Signed Theodora. So I've never quite, you know, grown out of that childhood, really, I don't think.
I read some of your short stories online. I've got to say, you're a fantastic writer with a powerful imagination. So what else is it that draws you to these darker themes in your writing?
That's a really good question. I think always there's a sense of place that you know, makes me interested in pursuing a particular kind of story. It always starts off with a place. So, for example, in I think the most recent one that you can access online, called A Real Boy, sort of a retelling of Pinocchio, but it's based on just when we were driving around Tuscany, me and my partner's family, during the summer holidays last year. And there are all these marionettes hanging from trees outside people's houses, and kind of weird spears sticking up in their garden. And then there was a hitchhiker waiting at the bus stop, and he had these very intense eyes, and we thought we'd better get out of here quickly. So I think, you know, it always does begin with a sense of place, and then any kind of stories that are attached to that. But also, I think I'm very interested in, I mean, it sounds very dark, you know, this, but interested in abuse and mental health issues. And so those are the themes that always come up in the writing as well. And kind of, you know, obviously these things are played out in the settings that are themselves very evocative.
As I understand, you love visiting spooky places, which we spoke about right at the beginning. And you're currently in a very spooky place, which most people wouldn't spend the night in with other people, let alone by themselves. So I think I read somewhere that you've not actually had any supernatural experiences in your adult life. Can I ask where your beliefs lie when it comes to the paranormal? Did you have any other experiences in childhood?
I mean, besides the entry that I just read for you about Southend Cottage, I think the only thing that could be construed as a supernatural experience from my childhood, which is again quite a weird thing, but I predicted the death, or I thought I predicted the death of Brian Moseley, who was an actor from Coronation Street. And I think this was during my Theodora phase. You know, I was just, you know, so entranced by that character. And I adopted this belief that I was psychic. And one night, this is when I was about 10 or so, I sat before the mirror and I sort of like tried to channel, you know, psychic energies. And I was like, I'm going to predict the death of somebody. I'm not going to leave this seat until I've written down the name of somebody who I think is going to die. And I wrote down, I didn't know his name. I just said, old guy from Coronation Street who just died in, you know, this episode. And then he died like a couple of weeks later after that. And I was sort of convinced from that point that I was psychic, but that's never really played out. I mean, you get feelings like everybody does, but I don't think I'm particularly psychic or anything. And so in terms of, yeah, beliefs, I would say that, yeah, I've become a lot more skeptical as I've got older. And I think that's to do with sort of studying quite a lot. So I was at university for, you know, 7 years. And I'm not saying, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not at all saying there's like this correlation between, you know, if you study more, then you're gonna definitely become more skeptical and cynical, and, you know, you're gonna shrug off these beliefs, because I don't think it works like that at all. But I think with the way that my mind works, I'm just so used to questioning everything that's translated itself into that more skeptical approach to, you know, things like the supernatural. But I think, you know, we need the supernatural. And I'm quite like Danny Robbins, I think, in that, you know, he's a skeptic who wants to believe. And I think if we didn't have this belief in like a world beyond ours, and if it was completely proven that these things couldn't possibly exist, which, you know, it never can be, but if that was the case, then I think we'd lose so much. You know, it's just such a kind of rich cultural heritage. And, you know, produces just so many great ideas in art that it would be such a shame if like the skeptical viewpoint became like the dominant narrative and we lost that, that more kind of mysterious side of things.
I couldn't agree more myself. As somebody with a podcast talking about ghost stories, I think that 99% of the time, there is a logical or scientific explanation as to what's going on. A lot of the time, it can be psychological. And yeah, so it's so important to have that air of skepticism when delving into the supernatural. But yeah, you know, like you're saying as well, it's just really fun as well. And as a human, just the mystery of it is really important. And yeah, it just gives a bit of fun and brings that to the surface. Can you talk about your experience of staying in Kentwell Hall?
Yeah, sure. So shall I give you a little bit of a history about the property and the stories that are told about it first?
That would be amazing. Yeah, so I spoke about it previously on a previous episode, but yeah, you could probably put it in much more poetic words than I ever could.
Well, I mean, I don't know about my poetic words, but there is an actual poem that I could read out, which is by this anonymous author, that mentions Kentwell Hall and like a ghostly incident that happened there.
Please go for it.
So I grew to know Kentwell Hall through Scaresville. So every year, obviously not during COVID, but before COVID and after, they have this event where all of the grounds are sort of transformed into this the wonderland of horror. And you have these structures where they build like maze-like passages, and then you go into different rooms and you can't find the exit. And then somebody will jump out of a hidden door dressed as a freaky clown or something. And they have like lots of different sites. So they'll have, you know, like a hillbilly property and sort of a Wild West and, you know, purgatory like imagery in another place. So it was really varied and like a really cool place. And I was there with my friend, and he's an archaeologist and a historian, and he knows the owner of Kentwell Hall really well. So he asked Philip and Judith if we could spend the night in this haunted bedroom, and they said yes, and I was really intrigued. So I did a little bit of looking into the history of it. So it's a Tudor hall. It was built in the early 16th century, and it was in the Moore family for quite a long time. So from 1706 to 1823. And the last Moore owner was Richard Moore. He had this very ill-fated marriage to a woman called Sydney Arabella Cotton. And the marriage ended because she was having an affair with the young steward, who was helping her with, inverted commas, bookkeeping while her husband was away. And they had a very public row, which then ended with the butler telling Richard that Sydney had been unfaithful, and they filed for divorce. And relevant to the story as well is that Richard was doing quite a lot of renovation work on the house. I mean, we say renovation work, but not actually renovating it, you know, very well. It was very ill-advised work. And he did away with the long gallery, which ran the length of the house. And then when it passed into the hands of the next owner, so Robert Hart Logan, who'd actually previously rented it, during his time as the owner, this haunted room was created from what was previously the long gallery. So the story goes that, you know, that there is a woman who haunts what used to be the long gallery, walking kind of above the current level of the floor, because the long gallery was 4 foot higher than the current rooms. And, you know, there's a possibility that this has sort of become intertwined with the history of Richard and Sydney and their very kind of public falling out. And, you know, this idea of a marriage that ended badly, even though obviously Sydney didn't die. She ended up marrying the steward, happily for her. But that might all kind of feed into it. And then we also have this ballad, which I can read to you if you've not already had that on the podcast.
Please do.
Yeah, this ballad, as far as I could tell, first appeared in 1825. So it was in this magazine called The Minerva. And it then, I think, was reprinted, or at least a note on this copy that I've seen of it said it was reprinted in Fulcher's Lady Sudbury's Pocketbook in 1838. But it must have been written before 1825 if it appeared in 1825. So probably before these renovations were taking place at Kentwell Hall, before the Long Gallery was destroyed. So I'll read it to you as best I can. "Listen, oh listen, and you shall hear the sound of a lady's lute. Anon the strain comes hurried and drear, and then the chords are mute. Look out, and you shall espy the form of a lady fair. Did you mark how slowly she glided by, and her look of wild despair? Behold her cheek as she passes again, 'tis pale as the cold, cold snow, and her heaving breast, how it throbs with pain, and how her tears, how fast they flow. And see, she snatches the lute once more to breathe out her evening song. Now heaven defend thee, lady fair, and shield thy life from wrong. And who is this lady whose soft lute tells a tale of such deep fraught woe? Oh, and why is her cheek so wan with grief? And why do her tears still flow? Hush, hush, 'tis a question you may not ask, or may not be answered here. Come away, come away, the night draws on, and such a sad tale you shall hear. The lightnings glare, and the rain beats fast, the wind blows sullen and strong, and the friends of the tempest are borne on the blast and shriek as they swoop along. Four men are seated in Kentwell Hall, carousing with drunken glee. Though the thunder roars and the hoarse winds howl, their wassail seems louder to be. Drink on, my merry men all, drink on," cries Sir Gilbert Vere. Sir Gilbert is master of Kentwell Hall, but why are these fierce men here? Sing on, my merry men all, sing on," cries Sir Gilbert Vere. Though abroad the tempest may badly brawl, it can never reach us here. Sorry, changing page. 'Tis the midnight hour, and lights are seen hurrying to and fro. Hush, did you mark how the wild winds keen came mingled with sounds of woe? And did you not see a figure in white by the fitful lightning's flash in the deep, deep moat to rise no more, fall down with a fearful splash? 'Tis gone, and the cold stream flows as before, flows on so calm and still. Now heaven defend that lady fair and shield her life from ill. Ride away, my merry men all, ride away," cries Sir Gilbert Vere. "And when we return to Kentwell Hall, again we'll hold good cheer. But Sir Gilbert may mix with the wassailing, but cannot know peace again. He may sit at the board, he may list men sing, but pangs in his bosom remain. And his cheek is wasted, his eyes sunk tight, and fearfully dark they scowl. He rests not by day, he sleeps not by night, and shudders when tempests howl. They used to be merry in Kentwell Hall, those revels are passed away. And the wayfaring man, who was wont to call, now journeys no more that way. And the huntsman's horn no longer sounds to the chase at break of day. No more are heard the deep-mouthed hounds when the wild deer stands at bay. There is a vast chamber in Kentwell Hall, and its walls are dismantled and bare. Save the light from yon lattice, 'tis desolate all, and no one may enter there. For in that room, wild shrieks are heard when the midnight storm blows shrill. And they say through yon lattice, strange lights are seen, and the lady is wandering still." So it's a really cool ballad. We don't know who wrote it. Patrick has a copy that is signed ALG, and he sort of inferred from that that it might have been Leveson Gower. But Francis Leveson Gower, obviously Francis, who is the poet alive at that time, his initial is an A. So we don't actually know who wrote that. But that's kind of one source of this white lady story. And the other source kind of comes from Patrick and Judith and their the accounts they've heard from people who've stayed in this haunted bedroom. So there are a few really good stories about that. So the previous owner of Kentwell, before they bought it in the 1970s, she reported hearing footsteps and the rustling of a dress in the middle of the room, 4 feet above the current level. So that was from Mrs. Starkey Bence. And then they've had friends come to stay and say they never wanted to stay there ever again. My personal favorite story that they told was his daughter was in the adjoining room. So it also used to be part of the Long Gallery, but was divided into this haunted room and the adjoining room. And his daughter was staying there, but she had to leave in the middle of the night. And she ended up camping outside her parents' door. And when they asked her why this was, she said there were too many people in the room. So this sense of it being kind of crowded with presences. So there was a lot of, you know, really promising stuff kind of leading up to me staying here. So I went along with my partner, who's even more of a skeptic than I am, not at all interested in horror, was actually slightly resentful of the fact that I was driving him out quite late on a Friday night after work, and he was feeling very tired. But anyway, he came along. And my friend, who knows Philip, and his husband, and we sort of actually started the night not in the haunted bedroom, but in the camera obscura. So there's this octagonal building that's one of the outhouses of Kentwell Hall. And, you know, it's like this little black box, really, where there's only a pinprick of light that's allowed in. And on a bright day, you can see the projection of Kentwell Hall on the walls. Obviously, it was nighttime when we went in there, so we wouldn't have seen that effect. And the other interesting thing is that it was completely decked up for the Scaresville. So I think this was just after Scaresville had taken place. And it was strewn with these enormous cobwebs. And we went in there because we'd heard from Philip that his daughter had gone in with some friends. And they'd had such a frightening experience that they ran out in the middle of the night and wandered around town and refused to come back until it was daylight. And they've never spoken about what it was that they experienced there. So I was really keen to go in. And, you know, we started off in sort of introducing ourselves, asking the presence to make itself known. And the only thing that happened there was that I tripped over one of the cobwebs, and that really freaked people out. But that wasn't a ghost. That was just me being clumsy. And we stayed there for a while and didn't really feel anything. So then we went up to the haunted bedroom, which is a really, you know, interesting room. It's got a lot of like Victorian decor still, and it's dominated by this huge double bed that we couldn't sleep in because it's, you know, a very precious piece of furniture. So we camped on the floor. And the wallpaper is all kind of damp and peeling, beautiful pattern of flowers and birds, but it is definitely looking worse for wear now. And then you kind of ascend upwards to the bathroom up these little this little set of stairs. And the bathroom itself is sort of possessed by pigeons. You can hear them scrambling around above you and calling out to each other. So, you know, it was a really, really good setting for, you know, staying the night, having a vigil. And we stayed up for quite a while. And then when sort of it was obvious that nothing was going to happen, people started settling down to sleep. I never actually sleep very well the first night somewhere anyway, so I knew I wasn't going to sleep brilliantly. So I mostly stayed awake all night. There was just one bit where I think I fell into a very light sleep and thought I heard my partner having a really frank conversation about our relationship with the other two people in the room. But I hope that was a dream. And the only thing really that I felt was cold, and that could very much be accounted for by the fact that I was lying on the floor in a sleeping bag. You know, I wasn't wrapped up in loads of blankets or anything. But my friend, who's the one who, you know, he knows Patrick and got us to go there in the first place, had some really, really creepy dreams. So, you know, this is all sort of written down in my blog in his own words. But, you know, he was dreaming about pieces of furniture moving by themselves, sort of like masses of flesh bubbling in the grounds and reaching out, and this idea that you could transform into something inhuman. And then when he was awake, he heard this voice that sounded, as he said, like a goblin voice, sounded very inhuman, just behind him and above him, saying yes. And he was utterly freaked out by this and said he would never stay there again. So the haunted room had an effect on one person, just not me.
That's crazy to hear about your friend's dream. What do you think was happening there? Do you think it was just the fear inside him of kind of knowing being in that place so creepy and spooky, you know, basically alone at night? And do you think it was just the fear that bubbled up in him, or do you think something paranormal was perhaps going on there?
Well, I mean, I would say it's probably most likely that, you know, the dreams themselves were inspired by this anxiety of being in this unfamiliar place that has a reputation. In terms of the voice, he says that he was fully awake when he heard it, so it wasn't part of like a hypnagogic state. So, I mean, he's convinced, but for me, I think there is this really kind of fine line between when you think you're awake and when when you're still experiencing some of those, you know, those things that you have during sleep. So last night, for instance, had a really bad night's sleep in this spooky place I'm staying in right now, because I was in this room at the top of the stairs, and you can see the staircase coming up. And that was making me feel quite paranoid anyway, because my head was just filling with visions of like, what if somebody comes up the stairs? What if I see a figure floating up like at the top of the banister or something? And what if I hear the pattering of feet? You know, it's just like, what if? And eventually I did end up falling asleep. And then I heard some sort of banging downstairs. And I don't know if that was in my dream or in the house. And then like a few minutes later, I felt like something almost shake the bed, like a bang that shake the bed. But again, that could have been a dream, because I had to really draw myself out of sleep, because I was saying to myself, look, I'm going to change rooms. I'm going to get out. And I sort of drew myself out of bed and made myself change rooms. It was really hard actually to pull myself out of that state of sleep. But it became like very conscious. So I think, you know, the boundary between what we're experiencing in our conscious mind and what is in our, you know, dream state is very, very thin.
You clearly don't have much anxiety staying in these places. I know I certainly couldn't stay in these so-called haunted locations alone. What is your goal when visiting these places? Do you do it just for the thrill? Are you looking for proof of paranormal activity? Or
I would say that I do have anxiety staying in places like this, but and certainly this week, because I'm here alone, and I'm here for, you know, from Monday to Saturday. So if anything did go bump in the night, or more so than what's actually happened, you know, it's not as if I'm near anyone here. Like there's a main road out there, and there's a house at the top of the hill, but it's ages away from this. So there's no phone signal here. So there's nothing I can do about it if I get really freaked out. I mean, I could drive away, but you know, I'd say when I'm on my own, I do psych myself out. And I think part of that is almost for the fun of it, even though it's not fun at the time. Like last night, I was not having fun. And like, if somebody was like, hey, you know, this could be the time where you would see an actual ghost and you would get kind of proof that these things existed, you'd have your very own experience. Like, would you like that to happen? I would have said no, because I was just too scared. But when I'm with other people, I think that's a whole different thing. So like at Kentwell, or when I went to Oliver Cromwell's house, I was going with the intention of hoping to have some sort of experience. And I think I'm like, I become very brave in those situations. I think it's just because I'm so keen and so enthusiastic. Like, I just want something to happen. So when I went to Oliver Cromwell's house, people were in like the study bit of the house, and they were saying, oh, you know, there's a shadow over there by the mannequin. It's hovering behind the mannequin. Can you see it on the wall? And then I went straight over there and I sat in the exact spot and sort of felt around to try and feel any cold spots or, you know, see something myself. And I couldn't really, apart from I was aware that there was a road nearby and that there were some car headlights. So I think I'm always almost desperate in those situations to find something that confirms like these more esoteric interests or like beliefs that I have. But yeah, on my own, I'm definitely not looking for that. It's more a sort of retrospective sense of fun.
So it seems to me that it's quite popular for centuries and centuries for writers such as yourself to go around to these locations and do their work, which you're doing right now. Do you tend to get much work done, much writing done when you're in a place like this by yourself? Or are you kind of distracted and procrastinating?
Well, I've only been here a day, and I would say that I had such a bad night's sleep last night that I wasn't productive this morning. So normally with my routine, I wake up about half eight and carry on till lunchtime. And then this morning, I'd had so little sleep the night before that I just let myself lie until half nine. By the time it got to like half 10, I'd started writing a bit, and then I actually went to go to a spa. So I wasn't being productive today at all, but we'll see. You know, there are a few more days. If I have a good night's night, hopefully I might be able to wake up a bit earlier and sort of feed off the atmosphere rather than letting it, you know, play havoc with my schedule.
as a writer, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. So a few months ago, I went to a place called Bury Pomeroy Castle down in Devon. I'm not sure if you're familiar, which has some really, really cool ghost stories there. So I went there for the day to have a look around. And I spoke to the guy on the ticket office, and he said a theory that I'd never heard before, and was just talking about ghosts and stuff and asking him about the stories. And he was a complete skeptic and had no interest in entertaining the ideas of ghosts. But his theory was that, so back when tourism became popular, and, you know, travel became more accessible, that writers were writing about these places, such as the place you're in right now and Kentwell Hall, to have these ghost stories to bring in tourism. And, you know, if that's true, it's absolutely worked, because a sucker like me goes to this place just because of that story. You know, don't get me wrong, the history alone and the architecture is beautiful, but the main reason I go to these places is because I'm fascinated with the stories. So yeah, I'd love to hear your take on his opinion on kind of writers creating these ghost stories at these places.
I think that's a really fascinating take on it. And I was just reading in this book called The Ghost, A Cultural History by Susan Cooper.
Just interjecting quickly there, Sophia messaged me and said it's actually by Susan Owens.
How it was like during the kind of the age of personality, so sort of the 18th century, that people started going to stately homes and, you know, these grand houses because of personalities attached to them. So, you know, you would go somewhere because, you know, a famous member of the royal family had lived there or was connected to it in some way. And then the ghost stories followed almost organically from that, because, you know, of course, if you're talking about where somebody lived, you then think about their death. And if their death was like, you know, unusual, or if there are, you know, interesting facts surrounding it, then that's going to generate more interest as well. So I would say it could be like more of a consequence rather than a cause, like because people are interested in these famous figures, like the ghost stories follow on from that. But I don't know. I mean, what I find really interesting is when you get like really modern properties, which people say, you know, they've experienced some sort of supernatural activity in, and it seems to have absolutely nothing to do with the house and nothing to do with them living there. It might be something deeper in the land. So we're kind of going back into the realm of folk horror here, I suppose, this sense that there is something deep down in the earth and kind of exists before, you know, the house does itself, before these famous people did, that is somehow bleeding through time and coming into the present. And I think there are certain, again, I think it's more about a sense of place. I think there are certain spots where, you know, they're almost like hot spots, you know, because of the conditions, the environmental conditions, you know, that it sort of encourages that response in people. So yeah, I don't know if that's a coherent answer really, but I think there are a few different things going on. One is landscape and one is personality.
Your ghost stories. Your ghost stories.
Sophia, it's been a pleasure to have you on, speaking to you and reading some of your stories previously. You're clearly very intelligent and articulate, so it's great to hear your take on things and just to get to know you a little. I'm looking forward to reading some more of your work. But for everybody listening that may be interested, where can people find more about you and your work?
So I've got a particularly badly made website. I've not been bothered to design like a proper website. So you can go to Sophia-Adamovich. So A-M-D, sorry. This is me being dyslexic, adamowicz.wixsite.com/website. And probably easier than that is just to find me on Twitter. So that's Sophia A with capital A _ writes. So yeah, like whenever I've got something new out, you'll find it on Twitter. You don't have to go to the badly made website.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put your Twitter and your website link in the bio for this, so anyone can just click that and go check it out. But yeah, what's next for you, Sophia?
So I'm trying to finish off a draft of this novel that I've been working on. It sounds really high-minded when you say that, but even though I introduce myself as a writer, yeah, I still don't feel like a writer. I feel like someone who writes. So yeah, so far I've not, you know, sold or published a big novel. So I'm just currently writing a draft of one, which is set around this area. It's actually set in my parents' village, and it's a folk horror. So I'm gonna hopefully finish that off and see what happens with that, if anything, and continue writing short stories, I think, and just see where they go. You know, if they end up sort of not going anywhere, at least I've had the cool experiences that inspire them.
Oh, great. Well, I wish you all the best and wish you nothing but success in the future with your writing.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much. Bye.